Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A full century before the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case that desegregated American schools, young black women in the Northeast were pushing for what they called equal school rights. In her new book, our guest today credits that activism of these young women in the 19th century as laying the groundwork for the civil rights movement 100 years later. We're talking with Cabrilla Baumgartner. She's an assistant professor of American Studies at UNH. Her new book is titled In Pursuit of Excellence, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. This hour, we'll dig into what she finds and later on talk about the conversation right now on anti-racism policies at UNH. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Cabrilla, welcome to The Exchange. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So for the black girls and women that you write about, education was more than just learning to read and write, learning French, learning history. You say it was a force multiplier for African-American men, women, and children. What was that force multiplier, Cabrilla?
Well, there was this sense that education could open up lots of possibilities for African-Americans. You know, we're thinking about the 19th century Northeast. We're talking about a time when African-Americans faced social, political, and legal discrimination, not to mention limited opportunities in employment and other parts of everyday life. So education opened up more opportunities for them so that they could have, be empowered socially, so that they could, be empowered politically and pursue, new economic opportunities. And if one person could do it, maybe that would open the door for more people and more people. And that way, that success would multiply.
So this is really, really, really important. Beyond educating the mind and learning certain skills or fields of knowledge, this is really central to these people's lives, Cabrilla, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, some of the women whom I discuss in the book are very much interested in expanding their mind, right? They want knowledge for knowledge's sake. But then there are others who recognize what a privilege that is, right, to have an opportunity to learn. And so they want to give back to their communities, oftentimes as teachers, but sometimes as lecturers in other positions in society. So it's a little bit of both. It's about their intellectual development. It's about their moral development, but it's also about a sense of community, activism, and responsibility.
Well, and you use the word moral development, and that comes a lot in describing these women in your book and the papers and materials around the time. The other word that comes up a lot, Cabrilla, is purposeful. Why was that so important to these women and girls in terms of seeking educational equity, this word purposeful?
Right. So it wasn't a word that sort of I read onto these young African-American women. It's a word that really comes out of their comments, right, their remarks, their writings. And what I noticed is that a lot of these African-American women as activists were asking themselves, how can we live our purpose amid the obstacles that we face? And for quite a few of them, education was the way. Now, I would argue that it wasn't the only way, but it was a very important path, considering that there were so few opportunities for women in general, but particularly African-American women. And so these young women were able to navigate and negotiate their sense of purpose through the field of education. And I define purposeful womanhood in the book as, you know, a purposeful woman being resilient, being resourceful and forward thinking. And these women then took those ideas, those characteristics, and they argued that they had an obligation to acquire knowledge, to shape, you know, the behaviors and attitudes of children and youth. If in any way they could, they were trying to transmit this knowledge. So they established literary societies. They pursued higher education in the ways that they could. They embarked on teaching careers. That was a very common profession for educated African-American women, right? Working as teachers, some opened schools, and then some, you know, were homemakers where they were instilling in their children this value of learning.
That word purposeful, how was it viewed by the wider community, by the white community? As you said, these women use this word a lot to describe themselves and their seriousness and their dedication to the effort.
Yeah, so I would say that there were other educational reformers in the early 19th century who also talked about purpose, right? And who linked education with a sense of purpose. So it's not an idea that's sort of unique to African Americans or African American women. There were certainly white educational reformers who also thought that education was a way to achieve one's purpose in life. But oftentimes, depending on some of those educational reformers, I'm thinking of someone like Horace Mann, who's called the, you know, father of public education because he established, really formalized public education in the early 19th century in Massachusetts. He really believed in something called Americanization. He believed that schools could be sites to Americanize recently arrived immigrants. And so schools didn't just have one purpose, right? This lofty romantic idea that they were, that people just sat, you know, children sat around in a classroom and learned. There were some other reasons, right, that schools were important. And for Horace Mann, it was really about Americanizing children.
Christian values were also fundamental to these young Black women, you write, Cabrilla, in their pursuit of education. What type of language did you hear them using, and how effective was that language?
Yes. So this is, I think, on full display in the first chapter of the book, which looks at the Prudence Crandall controversy. Prudence Crandall was a white Quaker woman. She had established a female seminary for white women, right? It's female seminary, and it operated in Canterbury, Connecticut. And she was very proud of this seminary. She won praise from Canterbury residents. Female seminaries, by the way, were very popular in the 19th century. You know, we think about Mount Holyoke College today in Western Massachusetts. That was a female seminary in the 19th century. So female seminaries were very popular. And Prudence Crandall had an opportunity to admit an African-American girl named Sarah Harris. And she was unsure at first whether or not she should do that. And ultimately she decided to admit this African-American girl, Sarah Harris. And that completely upset the residents in Canterbury. They were angry. They felt betrayed. And they did all that they could to stop Prudence Crandall from continuing with this, you know, interracial environment. And then Prudence Crandall decided, you know what, I'm going to open up a school just for Black girls and women. And she did that. And it was really quite amazing. She was able to recruit African-American girls and women from all over the Northeast. There were upwards of 30 African-American girls and women at her seminary. And, you know, in the book, I describe the difficulties that these young women faced. They were harassed. They were verbally assaulted. There were assaults on their school building. It was just cruel punishment that they experienced and they endured. And I found that in reaction to this harassment and this abuse, these young African-American women espoused an ethic of Christian love. It was almost kind of like what we think of as the beloved community of the 20th century. But you see it in the 19th century, where these women are talking about the need to love one another. They often quote Bible verses, right? They talk about the golden rule. They talk about, the Cain and Abel. They're just talking about humanity and respect and the need for that. And it was really quite a surprise to read that. They weren't militant. These young women were not militant in their response to this harassment. They were always trying to sort of appeal to the better side of their opponents. And, ultimately it didn't work because the school closed about 17 months after opening. So it opened in 1833, closed in 1834. This is the school for Black women. And it closed because the school was attacked yet again. And so these women, I think, learned a lot about themselves. They learned a lot about their activism. They held, steadfast to their Christian faith, but it did not allow them to stay at that school. And I think
it's interesting. Yeah. Well, and it sounds, when you read what they said, it sounds a lot like Martin Luther King. I'm quoting from your book here. They responded to white hostility with adopting and practicing an ethic of Christian love, naming prejudice and other forms of wrongdoing as anti-Christian. So there it is, Cabrilla. It sounds very much like some of the language used in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to actually trace that to the 19th century was surprising for me. The term beloved community is coined in the late 19th century. So Martin Luther King is not the person who coined the term, but he certainly popularized it and invested it with deeper meaning. But to trace that back to the 19th century, to these young Black women, was really quite incredible.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us today on The Exchange. We are talking about the themes raised in a new book by a UNH professor called In Pursuit of Knowledge, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. It's the story of young women and Black girls pursuing what they called school equity in the Northeast well before the Civil War. There's a lot of untold history here, and we invite your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or again, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Cabri, I want to pull out another word from that subtitle, activism. You describe these women and girls as pursuing education as activists. And I know this is a really important word for you. So tell us a little bit more about that word.
Yes. So I don't adopt a traditional definition of activism in the book. And by traditional, I mean, oftentimes, especially right now, right in our current moment, we think about activists as protesters, right, as participating in marches. And that is certainly a valued form of activism. But I look at activism a little bit more broadly. I think about, especially for some of these young women, what it would mean and what it meant for them to apply to go to a female seminary. So that might not seem at first like an activist position, but it absolutely is, because female seminaries were racially exclusive for the most part. The vast majority excluded Black women. So the fact that a Black woman will send an application to a proprietor asking for admission to a female seminary is most certainly an activist position. And there are other examples too in the book. We have examples of African-American girls and women filing lawsuits. We have examples of African-American women writing editorials and didactic literature. We have examples of women establishing literary societies, which might not, again, seem like that radical, but it is very important if in the 19th century people feel like African-Americans are intellectually inferior. By establishing those seminaries and literary institutions and literary societies, African-American women are saying, We are intellectually curious. We are smart. And we do want to debate certain issues and ideas.
What was it like for you, Cabrilla, starting out researching this project? Especially since, you know, again, this part of our history is not well known at all. To discover this group of, you know, Black women and girls doing this very brave work 100 years before the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. You know, I guess I was sort of predisposed to this subject area because of my own personal experiences, having seen my mother return to college in her mid-30s, and also witnessing the ways in which she encouraged my own intellectual growth. One of the things that she did was she ensured that I attended public schools, but that those public schools were located in the best school district, which was a little bit further from where I lived. And I'm from Los Angeles, California. And so there's really variation, right, in schools and school districts. And so she made sure to identify the best ones for me. And I was always interested in that. What makes a school the best or good? And why are certain schools tied to zip codes and property values? And so I suppose I've always been thinking about that. But it was really in graduate school when I learned about the Prudence Crandall case that I started to think more about the 19th century, the Northeast, and the earlier experiences of African-American women who are dealing with both, you know, gender inequality, but also racial inequality and sometimes class inequality. So how do all of these identities converge? And that's really what led me to this project.
I'm glad you mentioned the Northeast, because even though slavery in Northeastern states had been abolished by the time period that you're studying, the mid-1800s, your book does remind us, Cabrilla, that the Northeast was not a land of pure freedom by any stretch for Black Americans. What kind of restrictions did free Blacks in the North face in terms of education and careers?
Yes, so I think it's very important, and a lot of scholars have done research sort of tracing the history of slavery in New England, right, in the Northeast, even though by the mid-1800s, slavery had been abolished in pretty much Northeastern states. There were still ways in which the Northeast benefited from slavery in the South. And so part of that is that African-Americans who were free in the North experienced, you know, racial prejudice almost at every turn. They often were separated when they went to church. They had to sit in what they called Negro pews. They were separated in schools. They oftentimes not just had to deal with racially segregated schools, but even in certain towns that allowed Black children to attend, those children had to sit in a separate part of the classroom, right, at a separate desk by themselves. You also see discrimination in employment. So a lot of African-American women in particular were confined to domestic servants in positions as domestic servants. And men, quite a few men, actually, African-American men worked as mariners and sometimes as waiters. So there weren't a lot of opportunities for African-American women and men to pursue, different kinds of economic or employment opportunities. And so there's a way in which maybe education could open up those opportunities.
Well, and coming up, Cabrillo, maybe we can talk about some of the more specific examples around the Northeast, including lots of stories from Boston that are in your book and Massachusetts. So we will talk more in a moment about this history of 19th century Black girls and women and this new book about their struggle for education. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in with our summer raffle.
My favorite summer family tradition would be swimming out to the dock with all the little cousins and throwing them bodily off, playing King of the Raft.
Eating lots and lots of ice cream at all those seasonal ice cream shacks that pop up in the summer.
Driving on Sundays up to the White Mountains, and that first moment where you come into the Notch and the clouds are just sweeping in, it's so beautiful.
I love getting in the car, heading to the coast, and eating a lobster that's come right out of the ocean.
Wherever you go this summer, bring an HPR with you and make the summer car raffle part of your tradition by purchasing your tickets right now. Here's how to do it.
You can purchase your tickets at nhpr.org or by calling 1-888-805-6477. This is NHPR Summer Car Raffle, our annual tradition. We're asking you right now to take 2 minutes and purchase a couple of raffle tickets to support New Hampshire Public Radio. Do it right now. It is quick and easy to do online at nhpr.org. Or again, the phone number is 1-888-805-6477. I'm Todd Bookman. Here with more is Rebecca Lavoie.
Hey, Todd, how are you? It's nice to see you virtually on the screen there.
In spirit.
When you buy your raffle tickets today, you'll have a chance to win amazing prizes during NHPR Summer Car Raffle. You could win a 2021 Trek bike with a Yakima roof rack donated by S&W Sports. That's a bike rack. You don't have to choose the roof rack if you don't want to. That is your local bike shop since 1976, S&W Sports. Plus, you could win a stand-up paddleboard with a paddle and, of course, our grand prize of $25,000 toward a new car or $20,000 in cold hard cash. The sooner you get in on the fun, the more chances you have to win, and the more tickets you buy, the better the deal they are. You can get one chance for $50, three chances for $100, or six chances if you'd like for $150 or more. Just go to nhpr.org or call 888-805-6477.
We'll be right back to the exchange in a moment. It brings you conversations that matter to you, that matter to your community. And really, more than ever, the exchange is a valuable resource to help you learn about what is happening during these really extraordinary times in American life. So from looking at issues of history and culture to issues of science and politics, and of course, the coronavirus pandemic, these issues are discussed with insight. They're discussed with statewide experts and newsmakers. We hope you enjoy listening to The Exchange. We hope you'll take a minute right now to support The Exchange by participating in our summer raffle. It is easy to do. All you need to do is pick up a couple of tickets. Do it right now at nhpr.org or call 1-888-805-6477.
Join Martha from Hampton. She bought her raffle tickets, and she says, so happy to be listening to NHPR in real time. We lived in the Netherlands for several years, and NHPR helped my homesickness and kept me up to the minute with New Hampshire and U.S. News. Thank you so much for supporting your newly, again, local public radio station, Martha. Join her. Get some car raffle tickets right now. Every ticket you buy, all that money goes to support our local newsroom right here and the award-winning local reporting that we do. You can get a ticket for $50, three chances for $100, six for $150. You know, if you buy 35 tickets, Todd, they cost about $14 each. The more you buy, the better the deal. But it doesn't matter how many chances you take. Just take the chance. Head on over now to nhpr.org.
Remember, you're supporting New Hampshire Public Radio, but you're also giving yourself a chance to win some terrific prizes. The grand prize, $25,000 towards a new car or truck of your choice. Or this year, a special offer, $20,000 in cash, if that's your preference. You've got to buy a ticket to be entered, so don't wait. Do it right now, nhpr.org, or call 888-805-6477.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Edvest in You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency specializing in college student loans and student loan refinancing options, nhstudentloans.org. Sunny and hot for today. There is a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon in northern parts of the state. High temperatures today, mid-80s to around 90 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tonight. Northern New Hampshire will have some scattered showers in the evening. Low temperatures tonight in the 60s. Thursday, mostly sunny, some scattered showers, high temperatures in the 80s. It'll be partly to mostly sunny Friday, with high temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. For the weekend, Saturday, partly to mostly sunny, with highs in the 80s, and partly sunny Sunday, chance of showers, high temperatures upper 70s to lower 80s. You're listening to NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how Black women and girls in the 19th century built the foundation for educational equity. Our guest is Cabrilla Baumgartner, an assistant professor of American Studies at UNH and author of the new book, In Pursuit of Excellence, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. We are looking into this little-known story, and a little bit later on, we'll fast forward to the conversation about anti-racism policies at UNH. Exchange listeners, as always, we welcome your questions and comments. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So, Cabrilla, what New Hampshire connections are there to this broader story that you tell in your book about school desegregation in the Northeast?
Right. So there are two or three New Hampshire connections that I didn't expect to find. But in doing the research, that's what I found. The first is Rosetta Morrison, who is an African-American girl. She was born in Connecticut, early 1800s, and she was orphaned. And she ended up being bound out to service, which basically means she was a child who was purchased by a family. And in exchange for that family providing her room and board, she was to do labor for that family, usually domestic labor, cooking and cleaning and ironing and washing, that kind of thing. So she actually was a child servant. She was about 9 years old. She was a child servant in the household of William Rowland from Exeter, New Hampshire. And it appears as if she lived in that household until about the age of 17 or 18. It's not entirely clear. I don't have the sources to determine how long she was there. But her story actually follows that of Harriet Wilson, which a lot of people know, right? Harriet Wilson from Milford, New Hampshire, who was also a child servant. So you start to see, more examples of Black children especially being bound out to service in part because they're orphaned. So that's one New Hampshire connection. The other New Hampshire connection is related to the Equal School Rights Movement, which I talk about in the book. It's a movement that most people haven't heard of. I call it a precursor to school desegregation, the school desegregation movement, what we think of as the 20th century Brown v. Board. Well, you had an example of that in the 19th century. You had African-American girls and women fighting for their place at public schools in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, and in Connecticut. And remember, when I'm saying fighting for their place, this is at a moment where public education is funded with taxpayer money, just as it's funded today. And these African-American children had parents, of course, who were tax-paying citizens. And so children and their parents were arguing, if we pay taxes, we ought to have the same opportunities for schooling. And so you had young children, but also you had their parents pushing for this equal school rights movement, that is a quality education for all. And you saw that fight actually in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where the school committee actually had to justify why they were operating separate schools. And ultimately, by the 1850s, the Portsmouth School Committee decided to desegregate its schools because of the activism of these African-American women and their allies.
So interesting. And boy, there's so many echoes of what we saw, again, the 1950s and 60s. That's really interesting. And since we're talking about court cases, Cabrilla, tell us about, I don't want to call it the big one, but a major one. You've noted that this is the 170th anniversary, I think, of an important case called Roberts versus the City of Boston. This is really fundamental, Cabrilla. Why is this so important?
Yes, this is a really important case. It is the 170th anniversary this year. It involved a five-year-old African-American girl by the name of Sarah Roberts, and she sought admission to the public primary school closest to her home. And she lived with her parents and her siblings in Boston's West End. And the Boston School Committee expelled her. So she was able to go to that school for a couple of weeks, and then they expelled her because she was.
And we lost you there, Cabrilla. Sorry, we lost your connection there for a moment. Could you just repeat what you said, please?
Oh, sure. Yes. I was saying, so Sarah Roberts was a 5-year-old African-American girl. She had sought admission to the public primary school closest to her home. And she was able to attend for a couple of weeks. And then the Boston School Committee expelled her because she was Black. And her parents, Benjamin and Adeline, then sued the city of Boston, right, for violating this policy that allowed children to go to school closest to their home. The case wound its way through the courts and eventually reached the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. And so in 1850, Chief Justice Lemuel Shaw delivered the ruling, which was in favor of the city of Boston. And that basically said that the school committee could determine if they wanted to adopt a policy of racial segregation. So it was a real blow to African-American activists, right, pushing for equal school rights. This was the worst decision that could have come from the case. What's interesting is that this case set a precedent because the justices used the separate but equal doctrine. And we'll see that, of course, and maybe we think about that doctrine more when we think about Plessy v. Ferguson, right, of 1896, that case. And then, of course, we know that separate but equal is not going to be overturned until Brown v. Board.
Yeah, 100 years later. Yes,
exactly. So if we think about this case, Boston, the Northeast, separate but equal, it happened here and then became, law across the nation into, the 20th century. So it's a very important case for that reason. There are a couple of points I make in the book about the case. One is that public schools have always been a battleground over race, right? There's no getting around that. And I still think today, even amid all that's going on, public schools are still a battleground. Second is that I think the matter of equal school rights is urgent, and I think it's unfinished. So these young women really ushered in the movement. We sort of reenacted it, it seems, twice a century, but we still haven't equalized our schools, right? We still haven't democratized our schools, and that work needs to be done. And I actually think you're going to see some of those inequalities exacerbated because of COVID-19 and some of these decisions to move schools virtual. You have to think about, do students and children have access to the internet? Do they have high-speed internet? Not to mention, can their parents help them on computers? And do they have a computer? All these inequalities are going to get exacerbated. And I think this case is sort of a reminder of that. And then the last point is that I think activism is crucial. So even though this case was a major blow to the Black community, 5 years later, in 1855, a successful petition campaign actually resulted in legislation that opened up Massachusetts public schools to all children, regardless of race.
What's also so interesting to me about that story you just told about Roberts versus the city of Boston, and it's amazing now to hear you talk about, a child being kicked out simply because she was Black, but Massachusetts prides itself for its abolitionist history, Boston in particular, but you have so many examples in this book, Cabrilla, of Boston in particular, Massachusetts in general, where white people fought for the exact opposite of those abolitionist principles, especially when it came to education.
Right, right. So I call Massachusetts and sometimes the Northeast kind of Janus-faced. On the one hand, you have these major sort of progressive moments, inroads, right? You have moments of racial equality, fleeting moments. And then on the other side, you have just virulent racism. And they could be happening at the same time and in sort of connected events. And it's always, and so what I'm thinking about, especially our present moment, I'm thinking about that too. We see it now, that there can be all of these victories around race, but then you have defeats. So you do, you know, two steps forward, what, you know, one step forward, two steps back. You see that in the 19th century. And again, all I can say is that the activism of African Americans really pushed this along. We think about the Equal School Rights Movement, even though it's incomplete, you had the major push from African American leaders in the 19th century to change how schools were organized, how to open up more opportunities for African American children and youth. So I'm heartened by that, but absolutely, you do have this sort of Janus-faced nature, really, of Massachusetts and the Northeast.
Let's turn to the times we're in now, Cabrilla, since you're mentioning them and how they relate to your study of this history of racial equality in education. And you recently gave a presentation on institutional racism at UNH. What was that conversation like, Cabrilla?
You know, I would say that it was a difficult conversation. Maybe I had actually underestimated how difficult that conversation would be. I was speaking to a fairly large group of faculty, but also students and staff. And this is, you know, in the wake of, you know, the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And I think there were a lot of people, almost everybody, who's sympathetic, right? Who realizes those wrongs, and a lot of people who are inspired now and motivated to do something. I think the problem with the conversation, then we start thinking about systemic racism in healthcare, in education, right, in policing, is we often don't know exactly what to do. We don't know what to say. And sometimes we feel kind of caught, right? Like we don't exactly know what to do. And so it was a difficult conversation, in part because I had to, you know, I wanted to give examples of institutional racism in higher education at UNH. And I also wanted to outline action items, because I want us to not just be thinking about, well, here's what happened to me and here's how this was wrong. That's important. Those narratives are important, but I want us to act, right? I want us to be invested in similar strategies to ultimately eradicate institutional racism. And that's harder to do, right? That's the real challenge. And I think UNH, you know, as faculty, as students, we're working toward this, but it is hard work.
What was the reaction to some of the items that you brought up?
I think for the most part, faculty were, you know, understanding. You know, I gave examples of not personal experiences for me. I'm always quick to say my experiences as a faculty member at UNH has been really awesome, actually. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. I've had some great support. I work with great colleagues. I'm in a great department, and I have great students. And so it's just been a good experience for me. But I've had colleagues of color who've had really terrible experiences, they faced racism head on. And I wanted to share some of those examples. And I think there was a little bit of shock, some dismay. And maybe a desire to kind of explain it away as just, oh, that was just one person. But that's not how we all are. And, you know, that's quite frankly not helpful. If somebody has, you know, an experience, it's a racist experience, it's harmful, we need to talk about it. We don't need to dismiss it. We don't need to hide it. So I think that there's still that we're still grappling in some ways with, our thoughts and how to deal with this. It's maybe more than, especially with COVID-19, it seems to be a lot right now to deal with.
Well, hold on, Cabrilla, because we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll talk about what steps you think UNH and the university system need to take to be considered anti-racist. And we'll also hear from a UNH student involved in Black Lives Matter. We'll get her perspective. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We've been talking about a new book by a UNH professor on the history of 19th century Black women and girls fighting for educational equity in the Northeast. Now we're casting a contemporary eye on these issues, specifically at anti-racism efforts at UNH. Our guest is Cabrilla Baumgartner, an assistant professor of American Studies. And with us now is Julian Maduro, a UNH senior majoring in English and Justice Studies and organizer of a Black Lives Matter rally on campus earlier this month. And Julian, a big welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So as I said, you've been planning protests, calling for more anti-racist policies at UNH. What would you like to see, Julian? Where do you think the university falls short?
I think I want to see a more clear-cut way that UNH is going to deal with racist behavior. I think a lot of times when we talk about this subject, we like to throw around the term like zero tolerance policy. But so far, I haven't seen any sort of quote unquote zero tolerance at UNH for this sort of behavior. I know personally, I want to see a separate sort of conduct system to deal with racist behavior on campus to show students that it won't be tolerated. Also, in terms of Greek life, I want to make sure that we are holding the sororities and fraternities on our campus accountable for including diverse students and making sure that they are not perpetuating any sort of racist behavior within their organizations.
Where do you think the administration is coming down? How well do you think they heard your message?
I think UNH is at the beginning of the race, I guess. I think they're starting to hear the students. This year, I was able to do a webinar with President Jim Dean, and I think he is beginning to hear what students want and what students have to say in terms of racial justice on campus. But I think we have a long way to go. I think the orgs on campus, the organizations that represent student culture and different student identities are still organizations that aren't being celebrated at UNH. And I think that in terms of administration hearing students, so far we haven't had administration coming to these organization meetings. We haven't had administration sitting down with these students and asking them what they need from the UNH administration. So that's something I want to see come fall semester, and hopefully we can keep the momentum that I've seen President Dean have this summer. Hopefully we can keep that going in the fall.
What groups, Julian, are you thinking about for listeners who might not be familiar with some of the groups on campus? And when you say you don't see them being celebrated, what do you mean by that?
So I mean a few different groups. UNH has something called the Diversity Support Coalition on campus. This is an umbrella term that includes Black Student Union, the United Asian Coalition, Alliance, which is for LGBTQ students, as well as Hillel, which is a Jewish culture organization, the Native American Cultural Association, and Mosaico, which is a Latinx Heritage Association. These organizations are, I think, the front-facing groups for student culture on campus, and even those I haven't really seen a big show of UNH administration at these orgs. But behind the scenes, there's another group of organizations, things like NALA, which is for women of color, Most Deaf for men of color, QTPOC for queer trans people of color, and TransUNH for trans students on campus. These organizations are closed to the public student body, and they're open for the members that fit these identities to offer a safe space where they can air their grievances, but also celebrate their culture and their identities with other people who share these sorts of similarities. And right now, these organizations are unfunded by UNH. They cannot receive funding through the school, so they have to fundraise by themselves. But because they're a closed organization, that creates its own set of challenges. However, there are other organizations that are closed on campus that get funding. Organizations like SCOPE, which actually receives the most funding on campus. This org deals with concerts on campus. But in terms of NALA and QT, they don't see any sort of funding from UNH, because they are specifically for the identities that they attempt to support.
So just to clarify, groups typically can't close their membership to get UNH funding. Is that right, Julian? But in these instances, you're saying it's important that these groups are closed so that people feel safe. That's the conundrum, right?
Exactly, especially with organizations like TransUNH and QTPOC, which is for the queer trans people of color. Some of the members aren't completely out and aren't comfortable sharing those identities. So it's incredibly important that they remain closed so that students can feel safe and supported.
You know, Julian, as I said earlier, you've organized protests and you've been talking to the president of the university and you've been working on these issues. What are your plans for the fall, Julian, around this, given that it's kind of difficult right now with the pandemic and things feel very uncertain?
Yes. With the pandemic and COVID, it is going to be a little bit different. I'm hoping to continue my work within the organizations that I mentioned. I sort of have my hands in a lot of different buckets in that regard. I try to work with each of these organizations in different ways, supporting their events, helping them fundraise. In terms of NALA, I was co-chair a couple years ago, and I still try to support the efforts that the group makes in anything that I can do, whether it's cooking or helping them fundraise. I'm also going to be an RA in Res Life, and I try to bring any kind of education and celebration of culture into Res Life with me, making sure that I am keeping the people in that big group accountable and also making sure that I'm encouraging spaces for learning. I think I'm also just going to attempt to be a presence on campus in the best way that I can. As an RA, I want to make sure that I'm offering my students a safe space, you know, a friendly smile, a place where they can feel comfortable talking about anything on campus. I will be the RA of the inclusive floor on campus with gender-neutral bathrooms, a place where students can go if they don't feel necessarily represented in other sects of campus. So I'm hoping to just sort of be that friendly face and offer my support to the movement that way. I'm also working with some alumni to attempt to make reform on campus. I can't get too much into that because we're at the beginnings of that project, but hoping to actually look at curriculum reform in a way that better supports different identities, cultures, and histories as well.
And Julian, hold on for a moment, please. I want to bring Cabrea Baumgartner, our guest, back in. And Cabrea, as an historian, what connections are you making between what Black students at UNH are calling for right now and the women and girls who are the stars of your book, In Pursuit of Knowledge?
Right. I think there is an emphasis on equity in both of these examples. So in the 19th century, African-American girls and women and their allies are trying to democratize public schools and private female seminaries. They're trying to open up spaces for themselves. They're trying to advocate for their intellectual growth. They're trying to be counted as human and be seen as human. And I think in some ways in the 21st century now, we're seeing that same thing. We're still trying to democratize schools. We're still trying to find those spaces where we belong and where we are included. And you're also seeing the push for equity. And so in some ways, you know, there's been progress, but we still haven't quite got it right yet.
Julian, last question for you. If in a perfect world, what would you see happen on campus? What's sort of one thing that you would just love to see change on campus this fall?
I would love to see, I've been throwing around the word celebration, but I would love to see a celebration of culture on campus. Even though we are small in numbers, there is a community of people of color on campus, a community of people from different countries, from different cultures who want to share their culture. I mean, we have these groups that I've mentioned, but we also have events where you can learn to make foods from different countries, or you can learn a dance from a different country. We even have a carnival event where we bring in real carnival dancers to teach people how to samba and how to do different dances. And I think I just want to see more people taking advantage of this. I want to see more of a celebration of this culture, more people advertising these events, because I think in order for all of the people of color, for all of the students to feel like they belong at UNH, I think we need to show a sort of sense of support for all sorts of cultures and identities. And I think this is one way that we can come together as an entire UNH community.
Cabrea, how about you as a professor at UNH? What's one thing that you would really just cheer to see on campus this fall?
Thinking about the faculty side, I would love if President Dean announced that there's going to be a hiring or, you know, cluster hire initiative that's going to bring, you know, 10 to 12 faculty of color to the university, you know, in the next 2 years. I would love to see that. I think it's necessary. One of the stats I was looking at recently, as of 2016, there were only 6 Black faculty at UNH. 6. So, you know, the numbers aren't
just low. I mean, they're really poor. You know, there should be, especially at a research university, a prestigious research university like UNH, there should be far more faculty of color and more Black faculty. So I would like to see movement there.
Well, I want to thank both of our guests. We could have talked a lot more. That was Julian Modora, a UNH senior organizer of a Black Lives Matter rally on campus, and Cabrea Baumgartner, an assistant professor of American Studies, author of the new book that we talked about, In Pursuit of Excellence, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.